This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The most interesting thing from my point of view is it's the only hideous global problem we're facing where you can actually do something to protect your children and yourself from it.
Did you know that 300 years ago, people had larger jaws? Why would this be the case, and why is it important? Paul Ehrlich, the founding father of modern population sciences, is here to talk about his new book, which is a bit of a diversion from his usual work, warning us not to have too many kids. This time, Ehrlich, along with co-author and orthodontist Sandra Kahn, explore the links between jaw size and an increased risk of heart disease, cancer, sleep apnea, and hyperactivity. Today, Ehrlich discusses the evolutionary biology of jaws and talks about what people can do to reverse what he calls a hidden epidemic. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Paul Ehrlich. Paul is the Bing Professor of Population Studies Emeritus at Stanford, and he's the author of the 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb. Paul, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Very nice to be back.
So last time we had you on, we talked about a lot of interesting subjects relating to population, but you have a new book out that you co-authored with Sandra Kahn called Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic. It's definitely something that came to me as a little bit of a curveball, a population specialist talking about teeth and jaws. Explain the genesis of the project first, if you can.
Well, it came to me sort of as a surprise, too. I've been doing a lot of work on extinction with Gerardo Ceballos at the National University of Mexico, and he had been working with a couple of Americans on a conservation project. They had started an NGO in Mexico called Rainforest to Reef, and they had been looking particularly at the conservation of the jaguar. There's a couple, the woman, Sandra, is a very experienced orthodontist, and her husband David is an entrepreneur, and they had started an eco-resort near Zihuatanejo. And Gerardo just introduced us since they lived on the peninsula here in California. And we became friends and we discovered a mutual interest in fermented grape juice, which led to many dinners. And Sandra started talking to me about the problems she was seeing in orthodontics and particularly in trying to treat her own children. And she was convinced the whole field was going in the wrong direction, basically. And I was very embarrassed because, as she pointed out to me, and I had not ever questioned myself on this, why does almost everybody now have wisdom teeth that have to be extracted? And why is there so much crooked teeth and every kid having to wear braces and so on? It didn't make any sense evolutionarily. And of course, I'm an evolutionary biologist primarily. So we began looking at it and looking at some ideas that had been presented by other people, and it became crystal clear, fast, to me at least, that what we had seen was a gigantic evolutionary change as the human population grew. The need for more and more food for a growing population led to, as we all know, first about 8,000 years ago, an agricultural revolution. That allowed us to settle down, move indoors, and since a single person could grow enough food for several people, specialization, which led to industrialization. And to make a long story short, changing our environment to an industrial environment has had many effects on us, some of them very negative. All environmental, the 8,000 years is not enough time to have a significant genetic change in the human population, and it's led to the shrinkage of our jaws. And the shrinkage of our jaws may seem to you like a minor thing. Who cares? So people got a little crooked teeth, they can still eat. But the problem is that as your jaw shrinks, there's not enough room for your tongue. And when you then go to sleep, and particularly if you lie back, and particularly if you're a middle-aged obese male, you find you're awakened in the middle of the night by choking because the tongue blocks the airway. And that's called sleep apnea, and it's a gigantic stressor. And it's leading, among other things, to increases in cancer, in heart disease, in depression, even into Alzheimer's disease, as well as death on the highway and the actual risks in hospitals. It's a huge, huge problem for humanity. It's an environmental problem. It's tied in with population. And the most interesting thing from my point of view is it's the only hideous global problem we're facing where you can actually do something to protect your children and yourself from it.
So why is this a population problem, Mr. Population?
Well, it's not primarily a population problem in the sense that limiting the size of our population today would only have one positive population effect, namely there would be fewer people to suffer the consequences of this JAWS epidemic. On the other hand, if we hadn't grown such a large population, we could still be living as hunter-gatherers and therefore still have the full-size jaws and the lack of wisdom teeth and the lack of crowded teeth that characterized hunter-gatherers. When we have one of the best human paleontologists in the world at Stanford and Richard Klein, and he said he'd never seen a hunter-gatherer skull that didn't have a complete arch of teeth and had no crooked teeth. And Dan Lieberman at Harvard, another great human paleontologist, says the same thing.
And what do they attribute that to?
8,000 years ago, we had big jaws and all the last molars had plenty of room to erupt, so we didn't have wisdom teeth. And now our jaws not only have shrunk, but they're continuing to shrink. For example, if you go to Scandinavia and excavate a 300-year-old burial ground, which they've done, measure the jaws and compare them with current jaws in Scandinavia, they're smaller now than they were 300 years ago. And the basic reason, of course, is that we're getting to eat more and more liquid diets. That's one basic reason. We don't nurse our kids. If you can nurse your child, do it for years if you possibly can, because it turns out that nursing really exercises your jaw muscles, and pouring milk in from a bottle doesn't, even if it's the highly nutritious mother's milk. And then in the old days when we were hunter-gatherers, we weaned our kids to whatever we were eating, which meant they chewed, and actually they can chew before they have teeth. They can gum. And so the jaw muscles got proper development. And just think about it. What would your kids' legs be like if they weren't allowed to walk until they were 12? And now our diets are getting more and more liquid. When was the last time you ate a tough steak and chewed? We've selected our fruits to be almost liquid. I can buy a peach in a supermarket, poke a hole in it, and I could suck everything out of it. About the only fruit we chew is apples nowadays. The other thing we did was move indoors where allergens are concentrated, and so many of our children have stuffy noses for the first couple of years of their lives. If you stuff the nose of a rhesus monkey, its jaw development goes to hell. It becomes a mouth breather. Mouth breathing has been known for 200 years to be very bad for you because it changes the shape of your jaw and you don't take the air through your nose, which is designed to filter out nasty particles, to warm the air, to moisten the air, and to interject antibacterial things into it. So mouth breathing, which has become super common, you watch kids anywhere when they're not paying attention to eating or talking, and you see them hanging their jaws open. And so it's not surprising that we have this epidemic of tiny jaws, crooked teeth, and being awakened in the middle of the night. Snoring, for example, we're virtually convinced, didn't exist in hunter-gatherers. It's the first stage moving towards sleep apnea, towards choking in the middle of the night. And people think of snoring as normal. It isn't.
So I want to get back to the evolutionary angle of it from the hunter-gatherer period. You said that your colleagues at Stanford uniformly saw uniform teeth in ancient skulls.
And anything pre-industrial generally has a complete row, a complete arch of teeth ending in the last molars, which in many, if not most, modern jaws don't have room to erupt and become impacted.
And do they think that is purely a dietary issue, or do you think there's some kind of a selectivity there in terms of somebody with straight teeth might be more attractive, and so over generations, the straighter teeth people evolved?
Let's put it this way. People may be attracted to people with more straight teeth, but in order for that to occur genetically, for us to straighten our teeth again, I mean, after all, it's really going in the opposite direction, you would have to have a fairly strong selective pressure over many generations. Unhappily, the human generation is about 20 years long, so that if you really wanted to move teeth genetically, you would probably have to have a selection pressure where you killed off 95% of the people with crooked teeth for 1,000 years or so before you would see any genetic effect. In other words, when I was a kid, I did selection experiments on fruit flies. And in 10 generations, you could make fruit flies resistant to DDT. But the way you did it was to kill off 95 to 98% of the fruit flies with DDT each generation. We don't see anything remotely like that kind of selection pressure in humanity. So nobody thinks that the problem, I should say, no geneticist thinks that the problem of crooked teeth is basically a genetic problem. It's basically an environmental problem. And one of the difficulties with training in orthodontics is they get the idea that somehow this is, that crooked teeth are mama having too small a mouth and daddy having big teeth and the result being a crowded jaw. It's like thinking that if your daddy was a linebacker and mama was a model, that the little girl that is produced would have gigantic shoulders and very thin legs. In other words, it's genetically nonsense, but it is it's certainly evolutionary. It's just cultural evolution. We can skip the idea that this is a genetic problem. What it is a very large, very nasty environmental problem, which people can actually do something about. In other words, what are we facing? We're facing global climate disruption. There's no way you're going to protect your kids from climate disruption. We're facing the entire planet being soused with toxic chemicals. There's no way you can protect yourself or your kids from toxic chemicals in general. There's some things you can do that are reasonably smart, but you most of the time you can't even know when you're being exposed to them. We're facing a collapse of agriculture from a loss of ecosystem services because we're wiping out the other organisms on the planet. What can you do to protect your kid from the possibility of never, among other things, being able to see certain birds or go to Africa and see an actual elephant in the field and so on? You can't protect against that. But you can see to it that your kids are nursed as long as possible, if the woman can do it, that they're weaned at chewable foods, that they are not fed nothing but processed food, but with giving attention to the amount of chewing that's required. You can protect them if they go particularly to a daycare center, make sure they have the right things that prevent them from getting stuffy noses all the time. If they got a stuffy nose, treat it. So there's lots of things you can do. And if you look at our book, Jaws, you can see a list of the clues of whether and when your kids may need to get that kind of help. And it's early on. This is a problem of development, so that the earlier you start to give the kids the right background, the right environment for their jaws to develop properly, the better your chances are. By the way, one of the ways we know this isn't genetic is as we have a picture actually in the Jaws book, at least one, maybe more, of a grandfather who lived in not in an industrialized area, with a very nice jaw. Then the son that moved in part way in his life, and his jaw is much smaller. And then there's the grandson who lived his entire life in the industrialized area, and his jaw, he has almost none. You know, so you can see in two generations a huge change, and there's lots of examples of that sort of thing.
Chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 baby. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 chew your bubble gum, chew, 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 baby. First you pop, then you stop, the gum gets big and round. Blow your troubles away like bubbles when you hear that funny little sound. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum. Chew, 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 chew your bubble gum.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Ehrlich. His latest book is Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic. So, Paul, I read Yuval Harari's Sapiens a few years ago, and I can't help but think that your book would have been a nice addendum to one of the chapters in Sapiens. I don't know if you are familiar with the book.
I read it and enjoyed it. I thought it was that didn't agree with everything in it, but I thought it was a very nice summary of the general situation. I have been learning more and more in this area. It's really embarrassing to an evolutionary biologist who's been very interested in cultural evolution, doing research in it and so on, to realize that I had not paid enough attention to the gigantic environmental change caused by agriculture, I mean on us, the environments we're living in, and industrialization. There's really more and more stuff coming out about how incredibly important sleep is to our health and our longevity. And of course, the jaws problem is the main problem there is disrupting sleep. And now there's a literature building that says staying indoors with all those allergens not only helps wreck your jaw, it helps wreck your eyes. There is an epidemic of myopia, several really good articles on it, which can lead to things like retinal detachment and so on. The basic reason is we're spending too much time indoors. But there's no question, as far as I can see, that not only has this huge environmental and population-based environmental change led to the jaws epidemic, but it's also harming your eyes helping you to lose sleep. Because, of course, besides the sleep apnea, which, by the way, my daughter and several close friends are on CPAP machines, which try and avoid sleep apnea by pumping air in at a higher pressure while you're sleeping. But of course, moving indoors means you can have lights on all night. You could lose sleep in that direction as well.
Two parts that Harari talks about relating to skull size and the Industrial Revolution, I think, are relevant to your work in that he doesn't really hit upon the jaw and teeth alignment, but he talks about how cranium sizes were bigger, surprisingly, back in the hunter-gatherer period because we needed to do everything. We needed to know how to start fires. We needed to know how to take care of our kids and to hunt and gather.
Neanderthals had bigger heads than we
had. Right, and then with specialization, we actually got dumber in some ways. We didn't need to know as many things as we became farmers and workers in factories. But then he also talks about how time became kind of a factor with the advent of factories and industrialization because people had to work together in these factories. And so then you see sleep becoming one of those factors. And I can't help but think he would have liked to have added some of the research that you've come upon.
No, I would have loved to talk to him in both directions because I have written about what I call the culture gap because when I was a kid, I lived with the Eskimos, with the Inuit. But every Inuit basically knew their entire culture. I've written about a thing called, I call it the culture gap. That is, the women didn't hunt seals very much, but they knew how to do it. And the men didn't use the woman's knife very much, but they knew how to make one and how to use it. But now I'm talking to you on a cell phone. I don't have the first notion how it works, even though I'm, at least as in terms of schooling, I'm one of the more educated people in our society. But no matter how educated you are, you have only a tiny little bit of our cultural information.
Right. Like somebody from a developing country could say, yeah, I love these TVs. Can you make me one? You know, good luck with that.
Yeah, right. Or can you tell me where the parts came from and what they're made out of?
Right.
So we've changed a lot of things, and our culture has changed very, very dramatically. And hunter-gatherers obviously knew the whole thing. And they, by the way, with settling down and inventing agriculture, we also invented poverty. The hunter-gatherer societies were very egalitarian. The Kochs couldn't drag all their gold and oil fields and so on around along with them, mm-hmm. If we were hunter-gatherers again. So you would we've actually invented poverty and changed our entire culture.
I spent a lot of time in Japan in the 90s, and you don't really dive into this in the book, but I noticed the real stark approach to orthodontistry and dentistry in Japan, just living in another place basically gives you that insight. But the Japanese had no fluoride in their toothpaste. You had to like have friends who are coming over from the States bring you a tube of Crest with fluoride. They may have sold Colgate or Crest in Japan, but it was without fluoride. And I was told that the dental lobby in Japan was very strong, and they wanted to
make sure you had plenty of cavities.
They wanted to treat a lot of cavities, so they wanted to make a lot of money. But then on the flip side, the culture kind of embraced crooked teeth. That was considered cute. And so you rarely saw people with braces in the 90s in Japan, and people kind of eschewed orthodontistry. I just found that kind of, I don't know if that really connects anything with your book, but I found that one of the most advanced societies and second biggest economy or third biggest economy in the world had kind of flipped it around.
Yeah, well, of course, they don't do a lot of chewing, and they picked up utensils, which, you know, in the old days, you would tear a piece off a buffalo haunch and gnaw on it. But nowadays, you have knives and then forks and spoons, and you can cut food up into tiny little pieces. And so, again, it reduces the chewing. It's really very funny that the whole health care profession has somehow isolated the mouth from the rest of the body. You know, we talk all the time about exercising other muscles and use it or lose it and so on. And somehow the mouth has been exempted from this. So these things can change very, very rapidly, which in a sense is hopeful. If we reversed course and started seeing to it, I mean, for instance, Sandra and I are going to be sued by parents because we're recommending going back to chewing gum. She actually has a gum that can be re-chewed. It comes from a certain tree on an island in the Mediterranean. It tastes pretty good, and it's tough to chew. And we're going to try and push chewing gum companies to make gums that are not full of sugar and that require a lot of chewing, and encourage kids to do that. And there are other people interested in this same project.
Sounds like the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory Everlasting Gobstopper scheme. So you talk about the hopeful nature of this research. Let's say everything gets followed to a T in both industrialized and developing nations, and in 50 years, everybody's starting to chew their food, chew this special type of gum. They're approaching chewing with a new found vigor. They're breastfeeding their kids longer. They're using the advances in orthodontistry to realign things. What do you think that means for us as a people if we could fix this problem, Paul?
I think it would mean a lot less misery, a lot longer life, less cancer, less heart disease, fewer accidents on the road. Some of the recent sleep literature suggests that you're much more likely to be killed by a sleep-deprived driver than by a drunken driver. There'd be changes in medicine, for example. They'd stop, they are stopping in general, but having, you know, the 24-hour shifts for interns. If you have a sleep-deprived intern working on you, it's like having a drunk work on you. So if we did the things that we're now beginning to understand, and we skip the other huge problems, which we haven't time to get into. But if we keep going the way we are now, in a sense, making these changes, we'd have a lot less expense, a lot less misery. We would be moving, hopefully, in healthcare in general, in the right direction, which is towards prevention rather than cure. But as you sort of indicated, you can make money on cure a lot easier than you can on prevention. And unhappily, our entire medical system in the United States costs a huge amount of money but gets lousy results, largely because of the money-making aspect of it. So you got to make a lot of changes. I don't think we're going to see them very rapidly somehow.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Paul Ehrlich. If you are a family of means and you have a kid who's 8 to 15 years old, you're going to now maybe, after you've read Paul Ehrlich and Sandra Kahn's book, Jaws, you may be much more inclined to get braces for your kid or some kind of surgical procedure to fix their jaws if they have some jaw problems. But I don't see us reinventing our food system to start chewing more. I think that might be asking too much.
Can we get the baby food manufacturers to stop making so much pap and soup and make things that kids like that exercise their jaws? But one nice thing about it is, at least from my couple of years of experience in this, when you talk to people about it, they say, that's right. Now, well, why doesn't anybody talk about exercising your jaw muscles when we're being pushed to exercise every other muscle we've got? So it is sort of transparent once you think about it. And I think, by the way, our book is nonprofit. Anything we get from it, we've already got a huge investment in it, but any profit we get from it is going to go into our two institutes that are trying to deal with not just this problem, but with the other existential problems facing civilization. So I'm happy to flog the book without any feelings of guilt whatsoever.
Well, it's a fascinating addition to your fascinating career. And at first I was taken aback that you would take on this subject, but I think it's really a tribute to your intellectual curiosity and the great work you've done throughout the years. Jaws, The Story of a Hidden Epidemic by Sandra Kahn and Paul Ehrlich. Paul Ehrlich, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My great pleasure. Thank you for doing it.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Johnny Otis and Ella Fitzgerald.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.